Hey, it's Bill Radke. You know, if you heard our Week in Review this week on the radio, then you heard us talk about KUOW's pledge drive and how important your support is. But for you, right now, the podcast listener, we're bringing you the show without the pledge drive stuff. So enjoy the Week in Review with no interruption, but realize how vital your support is. We can do the Week in Review because you support KUOW financially. Right now, just go to KUOW.org, and thank you. Okay, this week's Friday Week in Review panel, we have city reporter for Crosscut.com, David Croman. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Thanks for coming. Monica Nicholsberg, civic innovation editor at the Seattle tech news site GeekWire. Welcome back, Monica.
Thanks for having me.
And the interim managing editor at Northwest News Network, Deborah Wong. Weren't you up late with the whole legislative session
thing?
Yes,
although they ended apparently early. It was like 9:30 when they were all done. So Austin Jenkins, who was covering it for us, was very happy. They didn't go past midnight.
That's amazing. And we're gonna talk about what the legislature did, what it failed to do this week. Don't worry, legislative news coming up. But first, I don't know. I feel like the big story in Seattle this week.
High fastball bounced into the hole on the right side for a base hit. Here's Batista around third. The throw to the plate, and Batista is meat. He is dead meat. What a throw by Ichiro. My, oh my, he's done it again. Another Ichiro Saturday night in Seattle. Unbelievable show by our man from Japan.
That's the late Dave Niehaus. I wish he were back. He's not, but Ichiro is back in Seattle. Ichiro Suzuki is my favorite sports figure in the world of all time. I mean that. He's a baseball star in Japan. He comes to Seattle at age 27, which is not young for an athlete. He's quiet and committed and talented and surprising and sometimes dryly funny, seems unflappable, multilingual, the global face of sports, and he makes the hometown team spectacular. It was just great to be around that time. He was here for the Mariners 2001 to 2012. So now he's back after he's age 44. He's been playing with some other teams. Then he's out of the league because, you know, the skills do deteriorate. And that's where I think it comes in, the fact that Seattle, I think a lot of people feel great about Ichiro coming back. But there are mixed feelings, David. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is sort of why I like sports a lot, because you could make a very rational argument for why bringing Ichiro back is actually not a very good idea. You know, the Mariners actually need pitching. They don't need, you know, an outfielder. A backup outfielder isn't what is going to put them in the playoffs.
But they have an injured outfielder and they need a backup, right?
Right, but people have been wanting them to make sort of big moves
all
offseason, and they haven't really done it. And so the one big move they make is bring back Ichiro, which, you know, rationally might not make a lot of sense, but emotionally, it makes a ton of sense. I'm totally excited to have Ichiro back.
It makes emotional sense.
Yeah.
And Monica, I thought you were asking a good question about this.
Well, I'm just curious whether this is for that emotional value, if it's a play for the fans to get them excited, or if he can be a real asset.
Yeah, I mean, he's not. I like that I've become the sports reporter on this.
Well, you told us before we went on that it sounds like you're the biggest sports fan.
I watch sports sometimes, yeah.
In public radio,
that's big.
That'll do. That'll do, David. That'll do.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he will play. The manager said he'll probably play 4 or 5 days a week, which is not nothing. But I would be skeptical that his return is going to be what the long-suffering Mariners really need to put them in the playoffs. And last time the Mariners decided to bring back a superstar that they once loved in Ken Griffey Jr., it ended in total disaster. So that is a possibility also.
Was it total disaster, or was it just, oh, he's not as good as he used to be? I get it.
Well, he wasn't very good, and then he left the Mariners literally in the middle of a game and, like, drove to the East Coast.
That's beautiful.
Well, you know, Bill, I haven't paid really close attention to baseball since I was a kid in Chicago, and I was a Cubs fan back in the era when Ernie Banks was playing baseball. So it's been a while. So I don't really I wasn't here for that magical rookie year in Seattle. So when I look at Ichiro today, I mean, just what he said to Larry Stone in the Seattle Times was really interesting. I thought he said, You know, when he was first came to Seattle, he was thinking about, you know, himself and his own accomplishments and achievements. But he says, now I'm thinking about what the Seattle Mariners need and what I can do to help. That's what I want to do. I want to be able to help the Seattle Mariners. I want to give it all, everything that I've gained, everything I've done in my career. I just want to give it all right here in Seattle. So how can you, I mean, how can you question that kind of commitment? I mean, that's like, you can just imagine, this is a guy who, I mean, we read about his, the way he trained and the way he got his kind of, you know, small body. He's not a big guy, but he had these ridiculous training regimens to get really, really strong. And so I just, it just seems like somebody for whom mind over matter really, really would matter in this kind of, I just think he's going to do great things for Seattle. I have no idea why, but it just seems like, wow, if you come here with that attitude, how can that fail?
And how many of us want to believe that mind over matter can work?
Yeah, right. Especially you know? When you're 44. I mean, that's the other great thing. I'm like rooting for this guy because he's 44.
Uh-huh.
I mean, for those, like, you know, older people like me, mm-hmm. I want to see older people succeed in a younger person's sport. I think that's the greatest thing.
As somebody who lives with one of those long-suffering Mariners fans, I hope that he can be a catalyst for change this season.
Yeah. It would be because life would be easier for you.
Absolutely.
So maybe each of us have our different favorite part about this. I flagged a quote from Ichiro, too. He, at the news conference where he came back to Seattle, he talked about, through an interpreter, he talked about how it was so hard for him in New York when he was used to being a star and an everyday player, and he wasn't anymore. They weren't always putting him in, and sometimes he couldn't hit well. And he says, I was able to learn from those experiences, and I was able to adapt and be able to go out and perform, even though the situations and atmospheres have changed. All those things I went through have made me who I am today, able to adapt to whatever comes my way. It's like, oh, are we talking about baseball anymore? Are we talking about life and you know, and angst and struggle? And I just love it. I just love the whole thing.
And he's always been that way.
Yeah. Yeah, did you read the ESPN piece about him?
I did.
Okay. Now, I know that in profiles, writers you got to pick an angle in a profile piece, right? And so this writer leaned pretty heavily on the pathetic is too strong, but kind of like noble and sad angle, I thought, right? So which makes you
obsessive angle.
An obsessive, yeah. He gave the sense that if Ichiro couldn't play baseball, I don't know whether he was joking, but someone asked him, what are you going to do when you quit playing? And he says, I think I'll just die.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I hope he's as adaptable and mind over matter and never say die and all that kind of stuff. That's what I want him to be.
Yeah, me too. And I think Mariners fans need something to root for. And so for right now,
yeah,
this'll do.
That'll do, Ichiro. What movie was that? That'll do. Babe.
Babe.
Right?
Babe. Yep.
Yeah, thank you.
You have to say it with an accent, though.
Yeah. Yeah. We should probably tweet that at KOW. What we're referencing. That'll do, pig. That'll do. What was he, Scottish? I don't know. So moving on. This is another thing this week. Big feature of the week. We will get to the legislature and other stuff. But this was the week Alexa laughed. Some customers reported that Amazon's Echo smart speaker occasionally, for no apparent reason, laughs. Like that. And a lot, according to media headlines, many people found it creepy that Alexa went.
Sure.
Not that. I was trying to play the first one. That. They found that creepy. So Monica from GeekWire, I get why we might not buy an Echo because it eavesdrops on us, but do people not understand that it's not actually a real laugh or a human?
Well, I think there's a ton of misunderstanding about this. It just started happening randomly. I mean, imagine if this device, like you're watching TV or cooking in the kitchen, and it just starts laughing. That is terrifying, especially at this moment when we're just sort of getting used to bringing these digital assistants into our lives. So Amazon said what's happening is that Alexa was mistakenly hearing this command, Alexa laugh. And they disabled that. I tested it this morning, and she won't respond to that anymore. They changed it to Alexa, can you laugh? But what's interesting—
And this is what the speaker now says when you say, can you laugh?
Sure, I can laugh. Tee-hee.
and that's different, right? That's different than the laugh that you just played before that people were hearing, which sounded more human and kind of menacing to me.
And the voice is prefacing it, so I heard you to ask me this question. I'm now answering it, and I'm giving a very non-threatening tee-hee instead of something more eerie.
Right. So I don't really know what was going on here. Before Amazon came out with this statement that she was just mishearing, there were these theories flying around that maybe there was malware that was affecting the devices, or somebody had written an app that was acting in the background. But Amazon says it was just a mistake. I mean, I call it a conspiracy theory. I feel like there must be more to the story than that, but I don't know.
I can see you feeling creepy for a moment until that you remember that it's a machine, but I'm skeptical that, first of all, how many people do you know heard this laugh?
I don't know how many exactly, but it was definitely a topic of discussion on Twitter.
Oh, believe me, it's on Twitter. But how many actual human beings, first person, heard the fake laugh? Because it feels like it could have been three for all I know. And it's been echoed all week about how it's creepy, it's bone-chilling, it's terrifying. Not really. It's a machine that makes a noise. My refrigerator makes a noise, too. And I get that if it's hackable and if it's eavesdropping on us, those are reasons to not have this smart speaker, but I think the creepy thing is overdone.
The context is that, and I have one of these speakers, which I like, and I plug it in occasionally. Whenever my husband sees it plugged in, he rips it out of the wall.
Okay, that's genuine creep. I respect that.
And no, but so when you set up your speaker, you have to basically decide which word you're going to use to turn it on. So usually people say Alexa or Echo. My family, there was a kid that they liked that they didn't like at school named Alexa, so they didn't want to call it Alexa.
Uh-huh.
So we actually named it Amazon, and it would sit on our kitchen table and constantly turn on because, well, what do we talk about at our kitchen table? Usually Amazon.
Really?
Amazon.
That's
usually
what passes for good
that's
conversation.
That's right. We're reading the newspaper. We read the newspaper like old-fashioned people, and we talk about what Amazon has been doing in Seattle lately. Of course, that's all we talk about.
Right.
So the speaker would constantly turn on and say, you know, ask what we were talking about or what we wanted, and it was completely creepy. So I think the context of this is that, you know, we have these devices on our kitchen tables. They record what we say. You can actually go into your device and look under settings and find your recordings of you talking to the speaker.
Right. And oh, but is it only when you've said the wake-up word?
Yes, we've said the wake-up word, and they keep these.
So we're told.
So, exactly. So yeah. We keep these, you know, they keep them for a while. You have to go in and actually manually delete them if you want to get rid of them. And occasionally it wakes up when you don't really expect that it's waking up. And listen to you. So it is creepy. The whole thing's creepy.
Well, the whole thing
says the person who owns one.
Exactly.
The whole thing's creepy, but we want to kind of forget that it's creepy. You know, it's very convenient and it's fun.
Uh-huh.
So then when it starts laughing, that whole curtain is totally drawn back.
We're
reminded that it's actually
like
creepy to have a microphone.
Yeah.
Do you all have one?
No.
I have one. And while we're trading creepy Alexa stories, this thing happened to me that I just feel like I need to share because I cannot stop thinking about it.
Mm.
I was watching a new Netflix show called Altered Carbon. It's like very sci-fi. And there's a character who is an artificial intelligence personality. And he was giving a soliloquy. And in the middle of it, Alexa started talking about Prime in my home. It was like I felt like my devices were plotting against me together. So it's exactly what David is talking about. It's just that we've been kind of lulled into this sense of comfort with these things because they are really convenient and kind of cool and fun. But when we're reminded of the fact that there's this device listening to us, it's like terrifying.
Some people are talking as if this is a PR problem for Amazon when it's the opposite, because here we are. We're continuing to talk. I don't call the thing Alexa because that's a wake-up word. It's not a person. It's not a human. It's not a woman. It's just a machine from a company. And the fact that we're all acting like it's creepy and talking about it by its name is just a huge victory. This is what Amazon wants us to think. It wants us to think of this as a person. In fact, they'll probably make this thing, if they really, aren't they working on making this Echo more relatable?
Yeah.
In which case, it should laugh more. It should have nervous laughter and awkward laughter, like a real person.
Earlier this year, there was the inaugural Alexa Prize was given to a team at the University of Washington. They won $500,000 from Amazon for developing a social bot that can have a real conversation with you. And the idea is it's taking all of this input from us and trying to figure out how people converse and how this bot can be more human-like. And so the idea is that the bot can ask you questions. The bot can, if there's a lull in the conversation, sort of start new topics. And that's what all of this information that it's getting is supposed to be I mean, there. I assume there are people out there who want to talk, have a conversation with Alexa.
Okay. When the Echo laughs and you don't think it's creepy anymore, that's when it's creepy. Okay. got it. This is the Week in Review on KOW, made possible by listener contributors. Let's take a quick break and get back with more news of the week. Your Week in Review team today is Deborah Wong, Interim Managing Editor, Northwest News Network, Monica Nicholsberg, Civic Innovation Editor at Seattle tech news site GeekWire, David Croman, City Reporter for Crosscut.com. And this week, our lawmakers made decisions that affect everybody in this state. The session ended last night. What was the most important or riveting legislation to you that lived or died this week? David?
I mean, for me, the biggest surprise and pretty significant is the passage of I-940, the change to Washington's law on if police officers who use deadly force can be prosecuted.
It's almost impossible now in Washington to charge an officer who was found to have wrongfully killed someone.
Right. So until the governor signs it, the current Washington law basically says you must prove that an officer acted out of malice in order to prosecute them, which is totally impossible because that would mean proving that they had, you know, evil in their heart or whatever, which is completely subjective.
That was rare in America that we had that state standard.
Yeah, I mean, it was really the highest bar out of anywhere in the United States. So people had been trying to change this for a long time, through initiative for the most part. So they tried a couple years ago and didn't get enough signatures to make the ballot. This year they did get enough signatures, and I think that's what really made the difference is that not only did they get enough signatures, but they did polling around it in Washington State, and it, you know, I think it had like 70% approval rating. It really looked like it was probably going to pass, and so I think that was enough pressure. It turned out in the end to force lawmakers to do something about it, because now, in theory, if all the sort of constitutional rules check out, that initiative will not go onto the ballot anymore because the lawmakers acted on it.
And is the law a watered-down version of what voters would have voted on, or is it basically the same?
It's a compromise. So the malice clause is gone, which is really the biggest part. But there were sort of two pieces to this law, which is you had to prove that an officer acted out of malice and also show that their decision to use deadly force was, you know, not in good faith. So the good faith part stays. That's still there. But what they've done is they've added sort of a definition of what it means to act in good faith, which is sort of, you know, what a, quote, reasonable officer would have done in the same situation, which you could argue is also a very sort of squishy definition. And, I don't think this new law is necessarily going to lead to a rash of new prosecutions against police officers, but it sort of removes the part where you have to look into an officer's heart and know how he or she felt.
Okay, so like it or not, that's a change around how we prosecute law enforcement officers right in this state. Monica, what was another achievement or something the legislature didn't do that you thought was really important?
To me, what was really interesting was the passage of Washington State's new net neutrality law, which basically is a direct, indirect defiance of the FCC's repeal of net neutrality back in December. So anyone
can you do the quick required reminder to listeners of what net neutrality is?
You bet I can.
Okay.
So basically it means in Washington State, if you're an internet provider, you can't slow down any lawful internet traffic and you can't create like a paid fast lane or the ability to buy better service, basically. So those protections were in existence until last December when the Federal Communications Commission repealed them, and Washington has filed or has passed its own bill that reinstates them. The language is almost identical, and that's really interesting because the FCC's repeal specifically says states you can't do this. It has what's called a preemption clause, which says local governments can't effectively pass their own de facto net neutrality, and Washington said, so what?
So is the saying, so what, is it going to, do you think it'll stand up, or is it pure posturing?
Well,
anti-Trump posturing?
Governor Inslee says that this is a consumer protection law, which is within Washington's rights. He said that he's aware that a legal challenge could be forthcoming, but his stance is basically the Trump administration makes threats all the time, and there's nothing to that leads me to believe that this is going to actually turn into a lawsuit.
How do you enforce that as a state? That's what I don't really understand.
This is a big test case. Washington is the first state to pass its own net neutrality laws. There are more than 20 other states that are considering similar legislation or executive orders, but we're really leading the way. So the coming months, what happens is really going to define what this means.
Deb Wong, what's another accomplishment or non-accomplishment from this legislative session that you just followed from beginning to end as the Northwest News Network?
Yes. Well, I mean, I think to me, the most interesting story was a bill that passed and then was vetoed. And you've talked about this a lot on this show.
Yeah.
So this is the public disclosure bill that applies to the legislature. And the background of this is that a bunch of news organizations sued the legislature because the legislature was refusing to disclose a number of emails, communications, and so forth, claiming that they didn't have to, even though we have something called the Public Records Act, which requires public agencies to open their records, because this is, you know, taxpayer money. That's your money and my money that's being spent, and it's the work of taxpayers. A judge decided, yes, that's true. The legislature is in contempt. They've been violating the Public Records Act. So the legislature came up with a new bill that basically exempts them from the Public Records Act and sets their own new standard for how and when they have to disclose. This all happened in kind of in the dead of night, almost. The bill was introduced. There was no public hearing, and then it was passed swiftly and sent to the governor.
No floor debate.
No public hearings. And for them, I think there was this feeling like, well, we're doing the right thing. The judicial branch has its own public disclosure requirements. We should have our own as well. But I don't think they realized that there was going to be a giant public backlash and, 12 newspapers across the state editorializing on their front pages and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of emails and phone calls to the governor's office. They were forced to sort of walk that back. The governor vetoed it, and they basically were forced to say, "I'm sorry."
So these lawmakers knew that this was unusual, that it was being rushed, and all of that. They voted for it anyway.
Yep.
And so now they have the chance to go back and rework it. But if they wanted so much to have this exemption from the Public Records Act, how could this possibly turn out this time? Now with all the debate.
I don't quite understand why they rushed this through and why they felt they had to have an exemption right now. I've heard theories too, and it sort of makes you wonder, like, well, why do they have to pull the curtain so tight?
A former legislator on this show, Chris Vance, mm-hmm. told us in his opinion that legislators had been going on their own theory that what they write, how they negotiate, what they say to lobbyists and back and forth and all of that is private
privileged,
and they really don't want every thing ever said written down, everything ever written down to be public. And that was his simple take on it.
Right. Well, if you file records requests from, say the city of Seattle, everybody who works in that city gets a day or two of public disclosure training. They're told, everything, made it very clear that everything you put in your emails could be public disclosure. And as a result, when you make requests for emails, the vast, vast majority of what you get back is very boring. The most sort of interesting thing you'll see is a problem will start to show up in an email, and then someone will send an email, say, stop by my office or give me a call. And then they cut off the conversation there. But if you'd been operating on the assumption that you didn't have to worry about that, all of those decisions are going to be in those emails. So I think, I'm not in Olympia, I'm a city reporter, but I have to imagine that there was a lot of very revealing and sort of embarrassing stuff in those emails.
Yeah.
My favorite thing about this story is just it can feel like what happens, in the state legislature and government in general is so out of our control. And this is the rare example of huge public outcry having a really immediate and big impact. And that was just it made it a fun story to track because it felt like the power was in the people's hands this time.
And it was one of these stories that when the lawsuit was in the courts, nobody paid attention to this. It just seemed like some weird little court story involving, I don't know what the newspapers were doing. But as soon as it became this story, the popular imagination just absolutely caught on. And Austin had a really funny quote in one of his stories where one legislator was saying, yeah, my husband was in a bar and everyone from the gun owners to the vegetarians were outraged about this. So it's just, yeah, it's just one of those things where, you know, you think we have a Public Records Act because we want government to be open. And that's how we make it accountable. And of all the people who you think the Public Records Act should apply to, it's probably politicians. I mean, I think there's a really good reason why people who are in elected office should be, you know, open about their communications.
But we're in the media. What do we know? We have diminishing time and just time. Monica, if you would, tell us about everyone hasn't followed the Equal Pay Opportunity Act, which passed in Olympia.
Sure. So this is an update to the state's equal pay law that was written in the 1940s. And it goes beyond saying that you can't pay men and women different salaries for equal work to say that you can't, as an employer, enact policies that restrict employees from discussing their salaries with one another. So some employers historically have had these policies, and the idea is that if everyone is being transparent about what they make, then it's easier to be accountable about, you know, who's getting paid what and if their gender or any other identity plays a role there. The other aspect of it is the employers in Washington State have to give equal access to opportunities, meaning if there's a promotion or job training or a way to advance up in your career, they need to provide that opportunity to everyone, regardless of their gender or identity.
And does that sound enforceable and companies get what that means and are going to go along?
Yeah, I get the understanding that the sponsor of this bill worked really closely with the technology industry and other employers in Washington to make it a workable bill for everyone. I think there were some reservations at certain stages. She told me that Amazon was concerned about cities passing their own kind of additional supplementary laws to this. So they wanted language in there that preempted them from doing that, that basically said this is the law and local jurisdictions aren't going to pass their own patchwork. That language didn't make it in the final bill. And I think that regardless, it is something that people are pretty happy with.
All week we've been telling you that the Washington legislature did pass the bump stock ban. Governor Inslee signed that. Did not pass 21 years of age to buy a semi-automatic rifle. The death penalty repeal never happened this session around. The carbon tax didn't happen again. We will continue to follow how these laws actually play out when they get implemented right here on KUOW Seattle. You're listening to The Week in Review. We're going to take a quick break and come right back. You made it to Friday and The Week in Review with David Croman, Deb Wong, and Monica Nicholsberg, and I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. This week, Seattle's interim police chief Carmen Best said police did the right thing by letting demonstrators block traffic downtown last Friday. The demonstrators don't want a new juvenile detention center. Some of them lay down in the street with their arms locked together inside tubes, hard for police to penetrate. Chief Best said, ideally, we would love for people to get permits, but the courts have said they're not required to. We assist people in their personal right to free speech. Nowhere does it say First Amendment right to free speech except if it's inconvenient. End of quote. Reaction to this?
I mean, yeah, this was an example of, I think, what police and police officers do all the time, which is they prioritize. You know, they don't, just because something's all law or discouraged or whatever doesn't mean that they absolutely 100% of the time have to enforce it. You get pulled over for speeding or whatever, and you know, half the time you get a ticket and half the time you get a warning. And so I think what we saw is just they've decided, and I think this is probably correct, that making a bunch of arrests probably would have been a bigger thing than just kind of letting the protest play out.
You know who says the opposite of that? The sheriff of King County. Their new sheriff, Mitzi Johanknik, told KTTH Radio that if King County traffic were disrupted like that, she would make arrests.
I don't know. I think that David is right. It would have been a much bigger issue for the Seattle PD if they had made arrests. And from the protesters' point of view, I mean, the whole point of demonstrations is to amplify your voice. And so the fact that it inconvenienced everyday people is very much the point. It means that this issue is now front of mind for them. So I think getting in the way of that, there would be, you know, constitutional concerns. And it seems like the police made the right call to me.
And I love what, I think it was Captain Chris Fowler with the Seattle Police Department. I think he told, I think it was the Seattle Times or something, but basically he was like, well, like anytime there's like even an accident, Seattle traffic is terrible. So this is going to basically happen anyway, but it would have been, you know, a shopping cart or something. So it might as well be protesters.
It was really funny. It was like, there's no point really trying to stop
right.
it.
Seattle traffic is so bad. You're already going to be waiting. You might as well just let the protesters
Have we
go.
Just given up? I mean, right. have we just kind of. Have we capitulated to Seattle traffic? Are we not going to go anywhere anymore? Is that sort of where we're at? I mean, I don't know.
Well, capitulating is an interesting word here because is the sense that the police are thinking if they make arrests, then that just makes demonstrators angry, and now maybe you have escalation? Is that the idea?
I find this whole thing kind of odd. I mean, I was not at this protest this week, but I've covered protests in the city before, and certainly in previous years, they have arrested protesters who have impeded traffic or done other things. I certainly remember during the WTO protests way back when that there were people who did the same thing, putting their arms into tubes, which makes it really hard to separate them. And I seem to remember them bringing out heavy machinery in that case.
Isn't that part of civil disobedience? You do something you're not supposed to do, and you get peacefully arrested.
And I think that's one of the issues. And it may just be a question of, maybe there's no book that says, okay, if you impede traffic in the entire city and there's, or if you impede traffic for three blocks, I mean, what's the standard? I know at some point there should be some sort of rule book that says here's where you step in. Should it be that subjective? I don't know. It seems really odd to me.
Usually they set like kind of guidelines in advance and they host all these press conferences before May Day or whatever, and they say, all right, we're going to let people march without permits the correct way down a one-way street, but the second you go the wrong way down a one-way street, like, you know, everybody's going to jail or whatever. Yeah. And, you know, I think it's, again, like I said before, I think it's discretionary. And
well, here's how discretionary it is. The police chief Best also said, at the end of the day, yes, people were inconvenienced, but nobody was arrested. Nobody got hurt. We made it known that if they're not gone by 3 o'clock, you're going to jail because we can't block off Fifth Avenue in Friday rush hour. So there is some kind of calculation about we've gone too far. That's too much of a traffic disruption.
I think that it could have been calculated in more ways than that, too. I mean, these protesters were protesting a youth jail, right? So they are targeting what they think is a misuse of police resources or perhaps priorities of the police that should be put elsewhere.
Right, over-incarceration.
And so if the police came out with this big show of force and arrested these demonstrators, then they could have been adding fuel to the fire as opposed to just sort of letting it play out and then die down. That might have, I don't know what they were thinking, but I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility.
One more story I want to get to before the end of the show and the successful end of a pledge drive hour, I hope. One more. This week, a King County judge ruled that you have a right to live in your vehicle without the government making it very expensive. Here's the story. A man was living in his truck in downtown Seattle, parking it illegally. The city towed his truck, charged him $550 in impound fees, and put a lien on the truck until he paid up. The man sued, and this week he won in King County Superior Court because the Washington Homestead Act of 1862 says the government can't force you to sell your home to pay debts, and the Eighth Amendment prohibits excessive fines. The city is appealing the verdict. What's important about this to any of you?
I mean, it's sort of this is another decision in a few decisions in recent years that has basically said, the word homeless, maybe we shouldn't take that as literally, that people do have homes. They just sort of are defined differently. And if we accept that, then we have to start following the Constitution in the same way that we would for somebody who is in a sort of more typical house. So there was a case, I think it was out of Vancouver, where someone, a man living in a tent, won a court case because a passing officer had like seen some methamphetamines in his tent and then made an arrest. But he got it overturned because the cop didn't have a warrant. And so this is sort of similar to that in that we're just seeing the courts, at least around here, sort of treat somebody who does not have a typical home, treat their situation as if they were in what we generally imagine as, say, your standard apartment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the alternative is if you impound the guy's car, he ends up sleeping under the bridge. There's no good alternative.
Or in a shelter, if there's enough shelter beds where he's willing to go.
Yeah, and this guy said he didn't want to sleep in a shelter because he was worried about his safety. But it also sort of, there's this reality now where there's a lot of people sleeping in their cars. I mean, I think the latest count showed that there are more people sleeping in cars than in tents or outside, unsheltered. So, that you know, we as a city haven't come to grips with this in any way whatsoever. And Danny Westneat had a column in the Seattle Times in which he said, let's find a place for people to park their cars overnight. And there are municipalities that have done this. I think he mentioned Santa Clara.
Santa Barbara.
And it, at a very low cost, like something like $400,000 for their entire overnight parking program, which obviously they don't have as many people as we do parked in cars, sleeping in cars. But
well, that's the concern some people in Seattle have. We have one safe parking zone in SoDo. We've tried to have more, but it turned out to be more expensive with the kind of services that Seattle wanted to have there. Very, very expensive. But I think the part of the pressure on the city leadership is the feeling that people have that you're, the more accommodation you make, the more you're inviting people to either to live in their cars or to move here from someplace else. So the city is really caught here, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that our laws and our enforcement of our laws have to deal with the reality that we have, not the one that we want. And the reality is that our homeless services are still leaving thousands of people unsheltered. And if we have a rise of people living in their cars, I mean, that means that people who are on the verge of homelessness, who maybe had a home and a car and lost their home but still have a car, are that number is growing, perhaps. So I think if you don't give this person a reasonable place where he can park and sleep, then it is sort of criminalizing the fact that he doesn't have a traditional home. And that's not, I don't think anybody would say that's fair or just.
And there's some court precedent for that. There's a decision at the federal level out of Idaho, I think, that essentially said that when a city, you know, if a city had enough shelter, the whole conversation would be totally different because then there's this option where they can go inside. But this court in Idaho basically said, well, you can't make arrests for trespassing if you're not providing alternative shelter. And so Seattle is sort of in that space where there's not really anywhere to go for a lot of these people.
And the city's appealed this ruling, and who knows, if it stands, maybe that's a tool to mandate more parking availability, live in your car. The city is saying we don't know who's living in the car and who's not. You're basically telling us, judge, that we can't tow and impound someone's car.
But they can tow, but they can't. I think they can tow, but they can't impound.
They can't charge the impound fees and require that they be paid. This could be a tool to force more accommodations, shelters, safe parking zones. It's going to be fascinating to watch as the city appeals that ruling. You've been listening to Week in Review. That's it for today. By the way, Seahawks traded Michael Bennett and released Richard Sherman this week. That was big news, too. The Super Bowl team falling apart, as we kind of knew it had to eventually. Thank you to our team this week. Deborah Wong, that is Northwest News Network. Favorite remaining Seahawk, Deb? You got a favorite?
Oh, please don't ask me.
Ichiro Suzuki. Monica Nicholsberg from GeekWire, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
David Croman, CrossCut.com. Who's your favorite Seahawk now that Richard Sherman and Michael Bennett?
Doug Baldwin.
Quieter. Yeah.
He sort of actually helped pass this deadly force law.
That's right. Yeah. Active in his own way. Week in Review. Thanks, everybody. I'm Bill Radke. Let's do it again next week.